Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are so many Texans in prison, and how does our incarceration rate influence the rest of the country? In an overall population of just under 25 million people, close to 750,000 Texas residents are currently under criminal justice supervision. Compare that to the entire United Kingdom, with more than 60 million residents and just 82,000 behind bars. The Tough on Crime activists point to falling Texas crime rates as evidence that the system is working. But that doesn't explain why crime has dropped more in the rest of the country, where incarceration rates are lower. So what does all this mean? How did our prison system become what it is today? Robert Perkinson is professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He explores the facts in his new book, Texas Tough: The Rise of America's Prison Empire. Robert, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
You have described Texas as the ground zero of America's prison boom. Can you talk about how we compare with the rest of the country?
The whole country has shifted into a much harsher incarceration posture over the last 40 years, but Texas has taken those trends to extremes. There are now 171,000 people roughly behind bars in Texas, which is more even than California, that has a much larger population base. There's more people in for-profit prison facilities, about 20,000 of them, more people in max isolation lockdown, about 10,000 of them, and of course a greater pace of executions than any other state. So it has, Texas has kind of national trends in sentencing severity and in scale. The good news is that right now there's a chance that even though Texas in a way led the country into mass incarceration, which is what a lot of people are calling it, may now be leading the way out.
You start the book with a discussion of Huntsville, which you call the most locked down town in the most imprisoned state in the most incarcerated country in the world. For those of us in this area who haven't been to Huntsville, can you talk about the kind of place it is?
Well, it's a quiet, mid-sized southern town with a nice public university, Sam Houston State, and a remodeled house and a central square. But if you start kind of poking around the numbers of the town, realize that its whole economy really circulates around incarceration. It's surrounded by, it's of course the Walls unit is the flagship and oldest prison in the state, erected in 1848, and then it's surrounded by a whole set of other units. Most people in Huntsville earn their living keeping other people behind bars. So it has really been the lifeblood of that.
I want to talk about this. Let's go back in history a little bit. Speak about the first prison in Texas.
Well, yeah, I try to use this book not just to provide a portrait of the huge prison system that has grown up in Texas and has influenced policy and practice across the country, but really to look at the ways that criminal justice policy and race relations and politics have been entwined since the Texas Revolution going forward. Texas built its first penitentiary at Huntsville just after statehood. It was built partially by slaves and also by prisoners within earshot of a slave market on the town square in Huntsville. It was originally reserved almost exclusively for whites because, according to antebellum penal statutes, African Americans, whether slave or free, could be punished only by hanging or by whipping. But Huntsville had a quite fascinating history during the Civil War. The prison cranked out a lot of the Confederate gray cloth used for uniforms and blankets and tents during the Civil War, in a time when slaves and convicts were working side by side around the clock at the prison's textile mill. But then really everything changed radically, and Texas's prison system took on its modern form after emancipation.
Because at that point, it sounds very much like the prison system was used to keep a lot of African-American men, at least, enslaved, in a matter of speaking.
In a matter of speaking, I mean, the first black felon boom in American history really took place in the years after emancipation, and especially as conservatives, former Confederates, clawed their way back to power at the end of Reconstruction, often through voter fraud and pretty extreme violence led by the Ku Klux Klan. In some ways, it was the most successful campaign of terrorism in American history. And as a number of slaves were, former slaves, were convicted, mostly of pretty petty crimes, stealing a pair of shoes, violating a work contract, and so on, they were sentenced to the a prison sentence, but like all southern states, Texas decided not to ship those new felons to the penitentiary at Huntsville, but to start hiring them out to private companies, railroad companies, mining companies, and especially sugar planters in Texas. The sugar industry had languished in Texas, but it was really rebuilt with the labor of convicts. And if many of your listeners probably have been to Sugar Land outside of Houston, and those towering smokestacks from the Imperial Sugar Company are really a monument to the ways that convict labor helped build the New South, just as slavery in many ways built the Old South. The convicts helped connect Texas to the first intercontinental rail links. Convicts cut the stone to build the state capitol after the first state capitol built by slaves burned to the ground. So a lot of what my book has tried to do is remember that Texas is also a southern state, although it's also a western state, and that's in some ways what makes the history so fascinating and has made it be a really interesting place for me to spend many, many months.
Well, how different was the approach to rehabilitation and incarceration in the northern part of the country post-Civil War?
Quite different, and somewhat before the Civil War, although the practices really diverge afterwards. Northern penitentiaries, for all of their severe failings, were created as idealistic institutions. Their goal was to restore wayward citizens to virtue through labor and penitent solitude. And even though that often didn't work out very well, rehabilitation is no easy business, it did in some ways mitigate the cruelties of those institutions in the North. But in the South, especially as large numbers of former slaves start entering the criminal justice system and are disciplined by the state instead of their masters, all of the penal systems in the South take on a much harsher tone, and they're really operated for profit. Not exactly in a new form of slavery or a kind of replacement for slavery, but a new system of order that grows out of the ashes of slavery. And, you know, the records are surprisingly rich from this period. I mean, there's an investigation outside of Dallas where prisoners were cutting down trees to build railroad ties. And, you know, out of a force of 80, 18 of them died within 4 months.
Huh.
Of starvation and beatings and being shot while trying to escape. And there were great fortunes made in this system known as convict leasing, but the human costs were really quite breathtaking.
And forgive the terminology here, but part of the reason that they could be worked to death was that at this point, as leased convicts, they were no one's property. No one had a vested interest in ensuring their human rights.
Yes, precisely. I mean, ironically and perversely, slave owners had invested a good amount of capital in purchasing another human being. I mean, the same sort of capital that any of us might use if we were to buy a high-end automobile, and they were traded in similarly crass terms. But, you know, if you're going out and spending the equivalent of, say, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in today's dollars, then you do want to keep that person alive. And you do want to harness that person's labor for the long term, whereas the companies who were leasing out convicts were just paying the state an annual or usually a monthly per head fee. fee, and as they wore those workers out, they could just send to the central penitentiary in Huntsville for more workers. And you can really see in the records that African-American, I mean, white prisoners were also victimized, and as well as Mexicans during this private, fully privatized penal system, but African-Americans were treated much, much worse. The punishments were harsher. Work quotas were higher. They tended to be dispatched to the kind of swampiest or harshest work locales. And, you know, the death toll associated with this really stretches into the hundreds, the high hundreds in Texas, and over the whole South, my estimate is that more than 30,000 people lost their lives in the convict leasing system. And it really is an underexplored and quite shameful chapter of American history.
So, Robert, how did that morph into things like chain gangs and state-run prison farms?
Well, great question. I mean, you know, one of the reasons Texas is so interesting to me is that its prison system is very much a southern prison system. You know, if you overlay a map of the counties, the East Texas counties and the coastal Texas counties that had large numbers of slaves, and look at where the prison system is centered even now, you'll see a remarkable, they coincide, that the prisons grew up in the former slave counties. But unlike other southern states like Louisiana or Mississippi or Arkansas, Texas really gave rise to much more powerful reform movements, and convict leasing was much more controversial in Texas than in other states. And Texas really led the way in kind of trying to reform the southern-style prison system that it built over a whole series of reform movements that I chronicle in the book. And the first was led by labor leaders, church leaders, newspaper reporters, and during the populist and in the progressive era, they finally were able to wipe out the for-profit convict lease system in the early part of the 20th century.
Let me have you stop there. We need to take a break. Robert Perkinson is with us. Sure. His new book is called Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, Robert Perkinson. His new book is called Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Robert, those reforms that came and that ended the convict leasing system, was there an eye toward rehabilitation at that point?
Well, there was supposed to be, and that was the hope of the leaders of that reform effort, most notably a former sheriff of Dallas, a guy named Ben Cable, and he very much tried to create a new sort of system, more like New York's Elmira penitentiary that had a kind of schooling and labor training element to it, but really, the legislature was never willing to pay for those sorts of programs, and racial politics really poisoned those legislative sessions, and politicians really required the prison system to generate most of its own operating revenue, primarily on the backs of African-American convicts working in the fields. And so Texas really did abolish convict leasing, but what happened, in essence, is that the state took over the same work sites that had been run by for-profit companies, by contractors, and then just started operating them for the profit of the state. And so the practices and the basis of Texas prisons that were set up on plantations continued. And that really continued, although there were lots of reforms in between, that continued all the way up until the 1980s, and to a certain extent, culturally, it continues still. When I started my research, you know, you could still see, and I think in some units you still can, in the pre-dawn hours, long lines of mostly African-American convicts trudging out to the fields, often to pick cotton or pick sugarcane under the watchful gaze of white guards armed on horseback, kind of almost in a way replicating the rhythms of slave labor, unlike anywhere else in the United States. This is the kind of closest, almost historic preservation that you have of the culture and practices of slavery anywhere.
Is there a benefit in terms of convict deportment to having a set of responsibilities every day?
Yes. I mean, it does make sense for, I mean, prisons that have robust labor or education or any sorts of programming tend to be calmer, better run prisons because you give people something to do, mm-hmm. and instead of just kind of festering and coming up with their own ideas of things to do. But the Texas model of labor up until the 80s was more labor to the point of exhaustion.
Yeah.
And not so infrequently to the point even of death, as people were often forced to work even when they were sick or had other illnesses. That starts to change with a big federal lawsuit, the Ruiz versus Estelle case, that changed the prison system pretty radically in the 1980s.
Here's a staggering statistic that you quote. In 1950, a black man in Texas had a 3% lifetime chance of going to prison. Today, it's a 29% chance. How did this happen?
Well, that to me was one of the riddles of this book, Chris, that I in some ways, these statistics still astonish me. You know, we live in the age of Obama. My family is all from the South. I have family in Texas, family in Mississippi, and family in Virginia. And when I hear their stories from the 30s or the 40s or the 50s or the 60s, you know, in their world, being able to look forward to a black president was almost inconceivable. And so we have traveled very far in U.S. race relations since the age of segregation, but somehow we are dispensing less equal justice today than we were 50 years ago. And that is quite astonishing. And it's something that can't be explained by racial variability in crime rates, and I argue it really has been determined in the field of politics.
How do African-American incarceration rates in Texas compare with college enrollment rates?
Across the country and in Texas, African-Americans generally are more likely to go to prison than to graduate from college. Among African-Americans who fail to graduate from high school, a majority of them can expect to end up doing prison times in their life. So it really has, for the poorest neighborhoods in Houston and Dallas and other parts of the state and other poor neighborhoods across the U.S., incarceration really has become one of the main interactions of government in these people's lives. Now, you know, some of this can be attributed to higher crime rates. There tends to be more crime in poorer neighborhoods, but the best statistical evidence suggests that a lot of it has to be attributed to both intentional and unintentional bias at all levels, from, you know, who gets arrested to who gets prosecuted, who gets charged with what, and who gets paroled. And what I try to show in the book is that really a lot of the sentencing statutes that have helped the prison system balloon have really grown out of a kind of political, the rise of the new right in politics and that began as a backlash against the civil rights movement.
Well, as reprehensible as it is, I think we can wrap our minds around racism as a reason why, as partially a reason why these rates are so inconsistent with the general population. But explain unintentional bias, how that could cause more African Americans by far to be incarcerated for similar crimes than people who are white.
Because there are a lot of seemingly race-neutral penalties that have had profound racial consequences. The most notorious is the disparate sentencing requirements for crack versus cocaine at the federal level that a lot of states followed. And, you know, crack and cocaine are pharmaceutically identical, we know now. And crack really isn't any more dangerous than cocaine, but we are still, even after the recent reforms that President Obama recently signed, we're still punishing crack offenses much more harshly than cocaine offenses.
And we should say the assumption is that more African-American drug users would choose crack and white drug users would choose cocaine.
even though there's no evidence that African Americans use illegal drugs more in greater percentages than whites. But they do, you know, there are kind of variances in who is using what type of drug. So that's one example, the crack cocaine disparities. But there's subtler ones, too, and I'll just give you one example. A whole lot of legislators in Texas and elsewhere in the 70s and 80s and 90s passed sentencing enhancements for anyone who's selling narcotics near a school, say within a mile of a school. And that was certainly not intended to exacerbate racial bias. It was intended to protect kids. But the reality, if you kind of look on the maps, is that in the most dense parts of Texas that are predominantly populated by Latinos and African Americans, there is no place on the map in the poorest wards of Houston that are more than a mile from a school, which means that everyone who is caught or accused of dealing drugs in that neighborhood is getting a sentencing enhancement, whether they were selling it to a kid or not. Whereas if you're, selling it on that outside of Waco in a more rural area, then you won't get the sentencing enhancement. And that's had quite profound racial effects.
How does our prison system shake out with regard to violent versus nonviolent offenders?
Most people who go to prison every year in Texas and the rest of the country are going in there for nonviolent offenses, property offenses, and drug offenses. Now, because people who are sentenced for violent offenses end up staying in there a lot longer, a slight majority of the actual prison beds at any given time are occupied by violent offenders. But as I point out in the book, you know, some of those beds are occupied by the really horrific predator types that stalk our nightmares, and that everybody, regardless of their political persuasion, wants behind bars. You know, the Ken McDuffs of the world, serial killers and serial rapists and child predators and so on. But even the vast majority of prison beds are not filled by people like that. And you can get a violent offense if you say are pulled over at a traffic stop and you are found to have marijuana in your car, and you also have a gun in the trunk. It doesn't mean that you actually use that gun against anyone else, but that can be considered a violent felony, or, you know, fights can be considered violent felonies. So the numbers of people who are in prison for the sorts of crimes that generate headlines are really quite small.
So let's set aside drug possession for a minute, because I think this bears more discussion down the line. But I think anyone who's been a victim of a nonviolent property crime but has been harmed by it feels that there ought to be some justice, some punishment for someone who has done this, if for no other reason than to deter future crimes. What do we do about people who are out there stealing cars and breaking into homes and businesses and not necessarily injuring anyone but causing damage?
These are questions with no easy answers, and part of the problem with our political system over the last 30 or 40 years, when crime has become a kind of politically divisive issue that has been used to craft attack ads and defend against attack ads, is that politicians have not been looking for the nimble answers to nettle some questions, but they've been looking for the most compelling sound bites: three strikes, zero tolerance, no second chances, and so on. But there are a whole variety of ways that we can intervene to try to prevent crime, to try to intervene in the lives of people who are committing crimes, and to try to get them onto a different path. None of them are perfect. But what I will say, and what I've kind of concluded over the course of this book, that if you look at all of the potential solutions to deal with the quite serious crime problem, and most all of us have been victimized by crime at some point, and if you were to try to craft the most wasteful, the most expensive, the most ineffective set of solutions to deal with the crime problem, that's what we've done in the United States over the last 40 years by choosing to warehouse hundreds of thousands of people. There's 2.3 million people behind bars in the United States right now. That's more than any other country in the world, even authoritarian states like China. And there's no democratic government in the history of the world that has ever done anything like it. And it is not, most experts agree, doing a very good job of protecting the public. And we'd be better off devoting those dollars to education, child abuse prevention, drug treatment, some of which is happening in Texas now, but is going to be a lot of those reforms that were enacted in 2007 are now in danger because of the looming budget shortfall.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Dormand in Dallas who writes, many reports indicate that effectively implemented preschool readiness programs, such as those in place in Denmark and France, could substantially reduce future prison and other criminal justice program expenditures. Do you agree with this? And if so, how do you feel public policymakers might be encouraged to look beyond the next year or two of increased costs to what they're saving over several generations?
Yeah, there's great data on a whole series of ways of intervening in very young people's lives. You know, getting younger kids into programs earlier, into kind of high-quality, standardized preschools that will get them ready for kindergarten in ways that low-income kids are often not, and will also bring these kids into contact with adults who can be on alert for signs of abuse or neglect at home. And when those kids' brains are really growing and their personalities are forming, if you can devote your dollars there, you know, the evidence is quite strong that you decrease the chances of juvenile delinquency and later adult offending. So you can spend money now and save a lot of money, you know, 20 years down the road. And the benefit, too, to choosing to fight crime through kind of socially helpful programs rather than punishments is that you don't have to worry about doing collateral damage. So if you throw a lot of money at an after-school basketball program, even if it turns out down the road that it didn't have the impact on crime rates that you had hoped, you've also created a program that was decent for kids and didn't cause any harm. Whereas if you experiment with ramping up penalties, you have done harm. You've kind of taken people who are already having trouble and cranked them out the other end, angrier, more stigmatized, less employable, and more prone toward acting out criminal behaviors than usually when they went in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. Great subject as always. My thoughts are about this, and I know we're talking about Texas for the most part, but my question I think is a little bit more kind of universal. You know, I tend to think about, you know, what is philosophically given to us as the idea of our penal system in this country, which is the idea of justice enacted through rehabilitation. I personally feel like that it is justice enacted through revenge, and that leads to dehumanization, making people in many cases much less human than they were before they came in, which in a lot of ways goes completely against the idea of putting someone back out into society that might actually be a better person than they went in. So I'd love to hear your guests' comments on that idea, and also just to kind of tie it into the idea of how our prison system and the philosophies that I was talking about earlier might either be the same as or different than other developed countries and their approaches towards penal systems and rehabilitation. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
That is a kind of a central theme of the book, the balance between, there's always in criminal justice sanctions a kind of balance between revenge, you know, punishing the offender for doing something that lawmakers have determined to be illegal, and rehabilitation, trying to act on their lives in some ways that they'll do something better. And there's always been a kind of balance. In the South, the just deserts approach has always been more prominent. In the northern states, historically, the rehabilitation philosophy tended to carry the day in the realm of ideas, if not always in practice. But what's happened over the last 40 years is that southern idea has become harsher. That was sort of forged in a way with angry racial politics, and that's gone national, so that we really have now shifted the scales all the way over to the revenge side of the equation. And we have not been paying very much attention to treatment. So we have actually cut back the money we're spending on prison education programs. We've eliminated a whole series of ways for prisoners to try to get their lives back on track. Meanwhile, we've been, you know, just churning billions and billions of dollars into tougher and tougher sanctions. We now spend $70 billion a year to lock people up. That's a lot of that's a lot of money that could be used for other purposes.
Robert Perkinson is my guest. He is professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. His book is called Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Perkinson. His new book is called Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Robert, if you are incarcerated in Texas for a drug possession charge, do you get drug treatment?
You may, but you may not. I mean, there have been some new monies put in place over the last few years. Texas has sort of shifted orientation, led by the legislature, to begin emphasizing treatment again, and there now is a whole series of kind of reentry coordinators and programs that have been set up. There are also diversion programs for low-level drug offenders to be put into residential drug treatment rather than going into a traditional prison. But they have not gone very far. We are still using prison as a punishment of first resort rather than last resort, and they are, I think, very much in peril in this coming legislative session. As some of the reforms champions have been moved out with the kind of Republican sweep, and like Jim McReynolds, for instance, and you know, the state is facing this gigantic, maybe $25 billion budget hole. And they're going to be looking to plug it in short-term ways that could have, I think, quite disastrous long-term consequences.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phones to Kay in Dallas. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I work for TDCJ, actually, and I had two things. A partial answer to your question, Chris, about the drug treatment is that there's quite a lot of drug treatment available both on the inside and after when they're released on parole. The problem is that there's so many offenders and so few resources that often you end up kind of chasing your tail, and there's a lot of there are only a small number of facilities that are funded by the state, and since offenders so often have very little income, they can't afford treatment on their own, and
right.
So there's not a lot, you know, to work with or as far as what's available, say, when they get out, which leads to my first kind of question is that, or maybe comment, is that there are so many, many programs, both before incarceration and once released on parole, that there are many programs, but they're all underfunded. They're primarily often staffed by church volunteers and whatnot. That there just never seems to be enough, and you often kind of feel like they're almost ineffective because they're so underfunded. There's such a lack of resources within the program itself, where it's a great idea, but it just is never seen all the way through. And I know that TDC employees feel like that on a constant basis, that they don't have enough to do what they're supposed to be doing for the offenders in order to keep them from going back to prison or to prevent them going to prison on, say, a new charge later on.
It sounds like a hugely frustrating problem.
It's it's a very frustrating problem on a daily basis. We're, you know, having to make do with what little we have because nobody wants to fund real effective programming. We end up having to fund something that'll do the trick.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds good on paper.
Some of the programs have been cut back. Like, it used to be that the biggest prison drug treatment program, Safe P, was a kind of 9-month program, and then that's been cut back further and further, not with based on any evidence of increased efficacy, but just to save money.
Yeah, our people do go to the substance abuse felony punishment facility, but the problem is the lack of the number of facilities, and a lot of times the what's available within Safe P is the offenders. It depends on the offender's outlook when they go in, because if they don't consider themselves to have a problem, then they don't really pay attention. There's not, you know, there's not enough within the prison system to convince them that there's a problem.
Yeah.
And
that's
so
exactly
the next thing I was wanting to also ask for a comment on was one thing that we noticed with a lot of offenders, not just African-American offenders or Hispanic offenders or white offenders, is this within our population, say, of our parolees, this almost expectation, this cultural expectation that to be a man, quote-unquote, to be a man, that prison's part of the deal, that, you know, a lot of these offenders had fathers and brothers and all and family members, mothers and sisters and whatnot that had been to prison previously, and that there's almost this expectation, not only, you know, statistically, as you were speaking of earlier, but also just kind of within the family or within the within that offender's.
So it's a right. It's a rite of passage.
Expectation they're going to go to prison in order to be a in order to be an adult, they have to go to prison.
What do you think about that, Robert?
Yeah, well, I found all of what she's saying to be correct in my interviews with corrections officers and, you know, treatment staff as well as inmates themselves. And TDCJ employees have an incredibly challenging mandate and work under quite trying circumstances and for pretty low pay compared to corrections officers in other states, notably California, and so as a result, the turnover also tends to be very high, which makes it harder to get these programs up and running, in addition to them being anemically funded, as she points out. And she's right, too, I think, that because of the statistics, because incarceration has become so commonplace and in certain neighborhoods, that it has become a kind of cultural expectation. Now, sadly, though, I hope, would see that as a crisis that requires government intervention. And we are seeing it as a crisis that requires government intervention, but what we're doing right now is making that worse. There's a very interesting kind of mapping program that some people out of New York have devised where you can go look at the amount of money that's being spent on some of the poorest blocks in cities, in Dallas or Houston. And you can see there's a lot of neighborhoods in the poorest wards. One city block where $2 or $3 or $4 million might be being expended by taxpayers to lock people up from that block. And you can imagine what sort of programs you might be able to run on a single block if you had a $2 million budget. But we're not putting our, as she says, we're not putting our resources into we're doing some of it and we're doing more of it, but we're not really putting our serious money into education, prevention, and treatment programs. We're putting our serious money into locking people up in cages, like livestock.
We have an email here from Nancy who writes, "On Monday, I was released from serving on a jury because of sentencing guidelines. If we found the defendant guilty of murder, we would have to sentence him to a minimum of 5 years in prison. We had no latitude to sentence him to a shorter time if the evidence warrants it. Why does Texas insist on using the term guidelines when it is, in fact, mandatory?"
Well, sometimes those jury instructions are not quite accurate, and the Supreme Court has become has been putting a little more pressure on judges to return more power to juries in some of these cases. So, you know, it could be that the jury might have been able to depart from those guidelines more than the jury instructions that she was given seemed to suggest. But what she points out is a glaring and serious problem that they've racked up in statute books across the country, these mandatory minimum sentences that for the last 40 years, every legislator wants to take home to his or her district some sort of sentencing enhancement, some sort of mandatory minimum so that they can either craft an ad showing they're tough on crime or defend themselves from someone who might be saying that they're soft on crime. And so our statute books have really gotten larded up with these felony statutes. There are 2,324 felony statutes on the books in Texas. And the result is that we've shifted a lot of discretion from judges and jurors who can kind of assess the facts of an individual case. Those decisions are now being made by legislators in the abstract or by prosecutors, and that's played a key role in inflating the size of the prison system in Texas and elsewhere.
So let's assume for the sake of argument that someone has served a felony sentence in Texas and really has decided to change his or her life. What are the impediments to that person going out and getting a straight-up 9-to-5 job after being released from prison?
Well, it's not to say that exceptional people can't still lead exceptionally successful careers in very difficult circumstances, but it's just requires almost heroic efforts and great luck on their part to really lead successful lives outside. I mean, especially during the economic crisis, employers really have their pick of who they want to hire, and someone who has to lawfully check the convicted of a felony box is often not going to be the first person hired. There's pretty good evidence now that African American men especially are not getting called back to interviews, even with identical resumes to their white counterparts, and this is across the country. So there's a lot of difficulties getting employment. Because Pell Grants are no longer available for people behind bars, it's very difficult to get any kind of advanced educational training while you're behind bars. You're often turned back to your neighborhood with no resources, no savings. You might have a little bit of time in a halfway house or a little bit of cash, but pretty soon you're on your own. And unless you have family support, some good luck, or just some exceptional skills, it is very hard for you to break out of this cycle. Now, Texas is trying to, and the federal government, too, have been trying to put more money into reentry programs, but they are still comparatively small compared to what we're spending on incarceration.
What do we know about what works to set up a really successful reentry program?
It's not easy, but we know if you can get people access, if you can have a seamless transition between being let out of the prison door into another program, that can help a great deal. Like one problem now that they're trying to work on is that you often, a lot of people in prison not only have drug addiction but other mental illnesses, and often serious ones, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder and others. And you often give that person a prescription to continue their medication, but they might not be able to get an appointment and get that prescription acted upon for a month or so after they've been released. So, and during that gap in the medication, you could have all sorts of behavioral problems. So if you can have a sort of seamless transition into a program that will look at the full gamut of the person's needs, that helps. And, you know, old-fashioned jobs programs, if you don't provide jobs for people and educational opportunities for people that really have to be subsidized, then it's going to be very hard for them to make it on their own. And job training has not worked nearly as well as actually giving people jobs.
Really?
Yeah, job training has been a sort of popular because it's cheaper than giving people jobs. But the fact of the matter is you're giving people training for jobs that in many cases just don't exist.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about the education system, and we're coming to the end of our hour here, but it is, on the one hand, you think, well, as long as someone is spending this time behind bars, they might as well get some education. But there's also an argument on the other side. People say, well, I had to work to pay for my own education, and I had to do it while doing other things. Can you sort of empathize with both arguments?
Yeah, and I think that's why crafting thoughtful criminal justice reforms really is implicated in the larger model of what sort of society we want to live in. And if we live in once upon a time, back when the great Texan Lyndon Johnson was in the White House, there was the effort, what they called the Great Society at the time, to kind of follow more of a European model in which people would not have to pay as much out of their pockets for health care or for education, and that we would as a society share some of those financial responsibilities. And if you have a society that is a little bit more cooperative and a little bit more involved, has a little bit more of a sharing ethos for everybody, then it becomes easier to justify more generous programs for people even though they've broken the law. If you have a system, as increasingly the case, where, you know, everybody is on their own, if you lose your job, now the unemployment benefits are expiring, you know, tough luck for you. You're soon going to lose your house. If you get sick or your kid gets sick, you know, you may not have access to anything other than emergency room care. The United States is the only country in the world in which that's the case, and Texas is the has the greatest number of uninsured people of any state.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Robert. We're out of time.
Okay,
Robert Perkinson's new book is called Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire. It's been a fascinating hour, Robert. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.